Then, with all the talk about global warming, we tightened our belts and we showed the world what we could do. And between 2000 and 2006, we tripled it. And now emissions are growing at over 3% a year. So we are headed on a runaway train right now to do the biggest experiment with our planet that humans have ever done. And we are just going to see what happens unless we dramatically change course, starting basically now.
Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good evening, Robin Williams with In Conversation, and today something of a follow-up. How are some sceptical and responsible scientists adjusting their opinions about climate change and energy use as the evidence mounts up in journals? Are they becoming more forthright or even desperate? Or are they calmly maintaining a prudent wait-and-see attitude? Well, of course, it depends on the scientist, but we'll hear from three of them today, starting with Nate Lewis, a professor of chemistry at Caltech, who is one of the authors of a policy document for America. This is Professor Lewis in 2006.
What we know, absolutely, is we know from the records of the geological ice core data that the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide over the past 670,000 years has never been above 300 parts per million. And we know that at the current rate that we're consuming fossil energy, that it will be at double that level or more within the next 40 years. We also know that there's no way to get rid of it, and so it will last for 1,000 years at that level until it naturally dissolves in the oceans.
Personally, what do you think? Are we going to make it?
I think there's doubt that the Earth would be identical or similar to the one we live in now at those levels of CO2. There's no way to know absolutely that it won't be okay, but a lot of the models, even if there's only a 10% chance that they're right, we only get one shot at this, and if we're wrong and the models are right, then the Earth really isn't a similar place to the one we live on now. So it really depends on how lucky we feel. I'm not going to take a stand on how lucky I feel. I'm not going to, being a 50-year-old person, maybe see the effects of that that'll kick in. You see, the Earth has a 35-year thermal inertia. And so what we're doing now is only the beginning, because we're waiting 35 years even to see the effects of what we did 35 years ago.
Nate Lewis in 2006. Worried, slightly equivocal, concerned, of course. But what does he say about climate and energy use 2 years later? Rather more exasperated, perhaps?
Well, the energy options for the world haven't changed, but our carbon emissions have. In fact, with all the talk about Kyoto, it's interesting to look at what we've done. Between 1990 and 1999, CO2 emissions globally rose at an annual rate of 1.1% per year. Then, with all the talk about global warming, we tightened our belts and we showed the world what we could do. And between 2000 and 2006, we tripled it. And now emissions are growing at over 3% a year. So we are headed on a runaway train right now to do the biggest experiment with our planet that humans have ever done, and we are just going to see what happens unless we dramatically change course, starting basically now.
Dramatically? So you're suggesting if it's a runaway, we can't do much about it?
We can, in principle, still hold the concentrations of carbon dioxide to something like 450 parts per million. But it's not enough to hold the rate of increase constant, because that just means you're continuing to adding debt to your credit card. We have to try to pay off our big balance, and we would have to cut emissions by something like 80% within the next 40 years in order to not be adding more CO2 to the atmosphere above some level that it won't go back down for millennia. So we only really have two choices. Decide that we're willing to take a risk with the only planet that we have, or decide that we can meet this challenge and we have an option not to fail as the choice that's in front of us.
Well, one of the problems with meeting that challenge is, just to add another figure to your statistics, you've got 90 million people a year being added to the burden, and you've got, in the next couple of decades, something like another billion who are going to put the figures up all the while, and at the same time you're supposed to be reducing despite that extra burden.
That's right. That's exactly the challenge. Most projections say that energy demand will double in 30 years and triple in 40 and 50 years because of population growth and economic growth, both in the developed and in the developing countries. If we held it constant, energy demand, that is, which the world has never done in human history, because CO2 emissions are cumulative, all that would do would be put off the date at which they would double from their pre-anthropogenic levels, from 2050 to 2065 or so. So it really doesn't help much in the big picture. You have to meet doubling of demand by basically saving as much energy as all the energy we now use on our planet combined, and making as much clean energy within our lifetimes as all the energy we used on our planet combined today, so that the arithmetic can work out. That's the challenge. We could do it if we chose to. We have technologies on the shelf. We have existing and incubating technologies. We just have to decide whether or not we're willing to roll the dice or we're willing to meet the challenge. And we get to decide that exactly once.
California is being held up as a great example of what could be done. How do you think you're doing as part of the front line of meeting the challenge?
California certainly has, from an overall portfolio viewpoint, one of the most aggressive clean energy strategies of any state, and arguably of almost any country, if you considered California a 10th or 11th biggest economy in the world. Over the last 20 years, energy consumption per capita in the United States has risen by 30%, but energy consumption per capita in California is flat. The reason for that is that we've enacted as a state good building codes, double pane windows, energy efficient vehicles, compact fluorescent light bulbs. So we know that if the rest of the United States just did tomorrow what California has done today, that we could save 30 or 40% of our energy right here, right now. You have to understand that CO2 doesn't just heat the earth. CO2, as anybody knows who's ever drunk a Coca-Cola or a soda, is an acid. When you add CO2 to water, it makes it acidic. Australians, I think, should be especially concerned because 20% of the coral is already bleached globally, and many, but not all, climate models predict that due to our acidification of the oceans, between half and all the coral will be bleached within our lifetimes. That means that your wonderful and highly economically profitable tourist economy based on the Great Barrier Reef and its wonderful coral may or may not ever be there to be seen again by any human on our planet. We simply have to decide if we're going to take the chance that that will go away or stop it now.
There are still some people, Professor Lewis, who say that the CO2 effect is not proven to be linked to human activity. Are you, as someone who involved in chemistry, sympathetic to that line of argument?
Let's separate what we know from what we don't know. We absolutely know that human activity from burning fossil fuels produces CO2 that goes into the air. When you get into your car and your gas tank is filled at the beginning and it's empty at the end, where do you think all that carbon dioxide went? It went into the air. You don't need to be a brain surgeon to understand that burning fossil fuels produces carbon dioxide. In addition, we know exactly how much fossil fuels we've burnt as a society every year. We know how much carbon dioxide goes into the air. And you know what? That's exactly how much we measure appears in the air before half of it partitions in the oceans and into the plants, which we understand. We've also isotopically labeled that carbon, so we know from its mix that the nail is in the coffin that human fossil fuel consumption is the main, most dominant, and almost exclusive cement production makes some CO2 also. But almost all of that CO2 rise is uniquely ascribable to human fossil fuel consumption. There is no question about that from the basic laws of chemistry. There is a question as to whether or not that rise in CO2, which beyond any shadow of a doubt is due to humans, is going to be dangerous and lead to climate change. We do know that for the last 670,000 straight years, that as temperatures have gone up and down, so have CO2 levels. We don't absolutely know what would happen when we doubled it, because the Earth has never been there before in modern human history. We are betting against 750,000 years of data and hoping that this time we get lucky.
My final question, given the options that you say are available of the new technology to provide energy, which are the two or three that you think really now seem to be the most likely?
If your concern is energy security, you will go to coal and potentially some nuclear. And in fact, the only three big cards we have to play are clean coal, nuclear power, and that enormous fusion reactor that nature gave us 93 million miles away, which is the sun. If we cleaned up coal, we need to prove it works. Because since CO2 lasts so long, it lasts for thousands of years in our atmosphere, you have to bury it for thousands of years. If it's buried for 100 years and 1% of it leaks, then after 100 years of burial, the amount that's emitted will be identical to what you mitigated in the first place. We need to show that every site in the world, the global average leak rate for 1,000 years is on average less than 0.1% per year. We have no scientific data to show that that does or does not yet happen, and that's what we should be striving for. Secondly, we could build nuclear power plants. If you want to hold CO2 to double, we would have to build a new nuclear power plant every day somewhere in the world for the next 38 straight years. And since they only last for 40 years, we would have to build a new nuclear power plant starting today somewhere forever. In addition, after 10 years, even all of Australia's uranium, in fact, all of the world's uranium, is insufficient, so we would have to start building them today out of plutonium, tens of thousands of plutonium-containing nuclear reactors, is a different world than the one that we live in, or probably the ones our children would like to live in if they made it there with tens of thousands of nuclear reactors. The only other option is the sun, because more energy from the sun hits the Earth in 1 hour than all the energy consumed on our planet in an entire year. No other resource is close. More energy from the sun in a year hits our Earth than all the energy consumed by humans in history, combined from all sources together. Australia has a tremendous solar resource. Every country has enough. We just simply have to find a way to capture, convert, and store sunlight, because if we just put solar cells up, we'll get energy at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a bright sunny day. But what do you do at night? What do you do in the winter? You have to find a way to store it. Plants do that. but not very efficiently. And so you need large areas. And so we need to come up with a technological way to harness the biggest resource that nature gave us, which is the sun.
Nate Lewis, who's Professor of Chemistry at Caltech, the California Institute of Technology. I'm Robin Williams, and my thanks to Kyla Slaven for help with this program.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.